Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the city of Gary, naming the second Monday in October Richard Gordon Hatcher Day. Brandon Smith reports on a House bill that would give legislature more power to weigh in on emergency declarations made by a governor. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Dr. Laura Cheever of the Health Resources and Services Administration's Ryan White's HIV AIDS program about National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The second Monday of every October will be known as Richard Gordon Hatcher Day across the city of Gary, replacing the controversial Columbus Day holiday. The second Monday of October also fits because it's around the same time of Hatcher's last public appearance before his death at the unveiling of his commemorative statue outside Gary City Hall on October 9, 2019. The Gary Common Council voted 8-1 on Tuesday night to make the calendar change official for city employees. Cities across the country have renamed Columbus Day for years to protest the brutal treatment of Native Americans by Christopher Columbus and European settlers, and to celebrate instead Indigenous Peoples Day or People's Day. The Times reports Councilman Michael Brown said this flips Columbus Day on its head and honors Hatcher, quote, in alliance with what a lot of communities have done, noting Hatcher paved the way for countless other Black men and women, including himself, in propelling them to public office. Hatcher was just 34 years old when he was elected in 1967 to lead Gary. He and Cleveland's Carl Stokes together became the first Black mayors of major American cities when they both took office on January 1, 1968. The five-term mayor led the Steel City until 1987, navigating through racial tensions, white flight, and a shrinking steel industry amid a crumbling housing stock and loss of downtown businesses. Hatcher died December 13, 2019, at the age of 86.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A bill sponsored by Hebron State Representative Michael Ellsworth that calls for increased accountability for elected county officials is out of committee and headed for vote in the Indiana House. Ellsworth says he drafted the measure as a result of former Lake County Recorder Michael Brown's not coming to work for 18 months because of a personnel issue with one of his staff members. Brown did not seek re-election, and his chief deputy recorder was elected into office last year. The measure, if passed and enacted into law, would provide an avenue for removing county elected officials who are not physically present in their office during regular office hours at least one workday each month during their elected term in office. Two resolutions would have to be passed to remove a county recorder, auditor, treasurer, surveyor, coroner, or assessor from office. County commissioners would pass one resolution followed by a county council resolution. The removed official can petition a court to review the findings. Ellsworth says those removed officials could just be voted out of office, but months could pass while taxpayers continue to pay them.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Most teachers and students won't have to quarantine anymore after a positive COVID-19 case in the classroom. That's according to new guidance from the Indiana State Department of Health. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says data suggests spread of the virus is rare in classrooms when everyone is wearing a mask.
We will no longer require quarantine or contact tracing if the students and teachers remain at least 3 feet apart and are wearing a mask at all times in just the classroom.
Box emphasizes the new guidance only applies to the classroom.
It does not apply to lunch, athletics, band, orchestra, choir, or any other school setting where students may gather.
Box says the new guidance takes effect Monday. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Small businesses in Indiana are one step closer to having access to additional financial aid from the state. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, a bill passed by the House Tuesday would provide funds to help small businesses that have been hit hard during the pandemic.
The proposed legislation will allow certain businesses to receive up to $50,000 in aid through the program that will be run by the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Businesses in the hospitality industry could be given preference. Representative Shane Lindauer authored the bill. He says the program builds on a previous one the governor started in the fall for small businesses using CARES Act money.
This program will continue to be administered by the IEDC, initial $30 million appropriation from the general fund. Additional funds from state grants, federal grants, gifts, and things like that can also be put into the fund.
Representative Jim Lucas was one of three lawmakers to vote against the bill, saying he was opposed to handing taxpayer dollars to specific groups when many others have been affected by the pandemic. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana would require all nursing homes to allow at least some limited visitation for their residents, even during a pandemic, under legislation unanimously approved by a Senate committee Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the proposed creation of an essential family caregiver program.
Indiana nursing homes cut off visitation during the pandemic, leaving many Hoosiers isolated from their families. Vicki Ayers' mother was one of them. She died late last year after Ayers says she deteriorated in isolation at a nursing home.
It is too late for my mom, but you can make a difference in the lives of thousands of people by requiring essential family caregivers access into the homes where their loved ones are waiting.
Legislation would require nursing homes to allow designated family members access even under emergency order lockdowns following federal government guidelines. Ayers notes those family members would still have to take precautions.
If staff can come and go, tested, screened, and with proper PPE, an essential family caregiver can do exactly the same thing and pose no additional risk to the residents or staff.
The bill heads to the full Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Indiana House unanimously approved a bill Tuesday that will hold police more accountable and significantly improve their training. The measure was crafted over the last year following protests around the country against police misconduct and racial inequality. Republican Representative Greg Stewart, the bill's author, says all police will now have to undergo de-escalation training. The legislation also includes $70 million to improve facilities at the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy, which trains a majority of police across the state.
Everything begins with training. The best training we can have will produce the best officers.
The measure makes it easier for the state to decertify police who commit misconduct, even if the officer is not criminally charged. Indiana Black Legislative Caucus Chair Robin Shackelford says decertification means they can't work as police anymore.
This legislation will also hold law enforcement officers accountable for their actions and prevent bad officers from bouncing from agency to agency.
The legislation also treats chokeholds like using a gun, only authorizing police to use them when deadly force is warranted. The bill now heads to the Senate. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A proposal to double Indiana's cigarette tax to $2 per pack has cleared its first hurdle at the State House. The House Committee on Public Health voted 8-3 Thursday to advance House Bill 1434, sponsored by State Representative Julie Althoff of Crown Point, to the House Ways and Means Committee for further review of its financial impact. Prior to voting, the health panel revised the measure to require a majority of Indiana's cigarette tax receipts to go toward Medicaid reimbursements for health care providers instead of being deposited in the general fund that pays for education, prisons, parks, and most everything else state government does. The Times reports Althoff's original proposal directed a majority of the estimated $175 million a year in new revenue generated by the cigarette tax hike to the general fund. She supported changing where the money goes because Medicaid covers the health care expenses of eligible smokers. Althoff said the underlying goal of the legislation is to reduce Indiana smoking rates, particularly among teens, by making cigarettes more costly. The measure also would impose an 8 cents per milliliter tax on e-liquid products containing nicotine that are used for vaping with electronic cigarettes. Even with a $2 per pack tax, cigarettes sold in Northwest Indiana still would be a bargain compared to Chicago, where state, county, and city taxes add a total of $7.16 to the retail price of a pack of cigarettes.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The work that people in public health do is often not very visible to most people. It's usually focused on long-term impacts like improving maternal health and encouraging flu shots. But when the COVID-19 pandemic hit the U.S. last spring, public health workers were thrown into the spotlight seemingly overnight. SideFX Public Media's Natalie Krebs reports this sudden shift has taken a huge toll on them.
Shelley Bickle was supposed to be retired by now. Following a three-decade public health career in rural southern Iowa, Bickle retired in 2018, only to be convinced to spend just one more year running the department in a neighboring county part-time. But last March, just as Bickle was about to hang up her public health hat for good, the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
And it just kind of hit us with a vengeance, and I felt like I couldn't just quit. And so here I am working since March 15th, 7 days a week, nonstop, going crazy.
Bickle says this pandemic is like nothing she's seen in her entire career. On top of working nonstop for Wayne County, she's also received a lot of pushback from the community on COVID-19 restrictions.
Oh, we've been called every name in the book. And we've been hung up on, we've been threatened.
Bickle isn't the only public health worker in this position. Penny Tynesma is a nurse with the Tama County Public Health Department. She says one parent called so upset about quarantine requirements for school sports teams, he started talking about 1930s Germany.
And I said, hold on for a second. Are you comparing public health to Nazi Germany? And he said, yes, I am.
Tynesma works closely with Tama County Director Shannon Zofka, who says she was barely able to take a few days off to get married last summer.
I don't think we even realize the amount of stress we're under, the exhaustion. I mean, the month of November was so chaotic with the surge. It was insane.
Many public health workers are facing this kind of incredible pressure at the moment. Jesse Gold is a professor of psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis. She says not only is the work grueling, many public health workers have been thrust into the spotlight, making them a target for people who are feeling anxious during a very scary and uncertain time.
The public health official is the face of your job security, your livelihood not existing. And so it's displaced anger because you don't understand why that person took it from you.
And all this has taken a toll on workers. A recent Associated Press investigation shows that more than 180 state and local department leaders across the country have left or have been fired during the pandemic. Midwestern states like Iowa, Missouri, and Kentucky have been hit hard. Gold expects many more workers to leave once things calm down and they're no longer doing what she calls stopping the bleed.
But I do think very much so that when the adrenaline settles and this stops, that you go, what am I doing? And what was that? And do I like this? And am I valued?
This is what concerned Becky Wolf, who heads the department in rural Greene County. She says for months, like many, she and her two public health nurses were working really long hours. But this fall, once they got through the worst of the state's third COVID-19 spike, Wolf had what she calls her pandemic, quote, come to Jesus moment.
We're not going to be able to last if we don't start taking care of ourselves and try and get a hold of things.
Wolf says her team has had to temporarily shelve their overachiever mindset. They now strive to work just 8 hours a day, leaving by 5 p.m. Part of the reason, she says, is to save energy for the huge logistical challenge of distributing the vaccine. And it's not just small departments facing this challenge. Nola Agner-Davis is with the department in Polk County, where Des Moines is located. She says its 42-person team is also anticipating that vaccine distribution will be hard.
We know it may take a while, but once you see that little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, you're like, okay, well, we can do this. We can keep doing this.
Agner-Davis says her department has yet to lose any employees to pandemic stress. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Dr. Laura Cheever.
February 7th is National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. To find out more about the event coming up and about the topic in general, we have with us Dr. Laura Cheever. She's a physician and she's the Associate Administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration. Dr. Cheever, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
We know that that your organization and you in particular are very much involved in the Rhine-wide HIV/AIDS program. And that's one of the reasons that they take advantage of this very special day every year to make sure that Blacks, African-Americans who face the stigma and HIV-related health problems know about the help they can get through the organizations that are out there. Will you bring us up to date first for folks that are not familiar with what the HIV/AIDS Bureau is all about?
Yes. So the HIV/AIDS Bureau administers the Rhine-White HIV/AIDS Program, which is a federal program that's funded at about $2.3 billion a year. And it really is to provide HIV care and treatment services for people who don't have the means to get that treatment on their own. Either they're uninsured or underinsured, living at or below poverty. The program serves about half of all the people living with diagnosed HIV in this country. And we do that by funding states, cities, and local community-based organizations to provide HIV care and treatment and wraparound services.
I know a lot has been done over the years to be able to show that HIV is able to be managed, and it's gone from a very deadly disease to something that is very manageable. Will you tell us first about how some of the treatments are able to contain the disease and make it easier for people to survive, even when they may have been given a death sentence, so to speak, early?
Yes. So back when I first started providing HIV services in 1990, HIV was a death sentence. Most people diagnosed would be dead within a year or two. Today, because we have incredibly important advances in medical care and treatment, most people diagnosed with HIV can be started on one pill that they take once a day for the rest of their lives. If they are able to take that medication every day, they can become virally suppressed, which means they can live a near normal lifespan and have effectively no risk of transmitting HIV sexually to someone else. So it helps the person live a good, healthy, normal life and helps them from preventing HIV transmission to their loved ones.
What seem to be the statistics nationwide that show that that blacks in particular seem to be not as much perceptive about the disease, but they are maybe unaware of sometimes being alive and don't have the virus in them?
Yeah, so we definitely have some big disparities in HIV care in America. Of all the people diagnosed in 2018, 42% were African American, but they only composed 13% of the U.S. population. So you can really see how it much more heavily impacts the African American community. And that's similar to a lot of diseases. We've seen impacts, for example, of COVID and other illnesses that are just more impactful in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in the Ryan White program, when people get into care, they're provided care in a way that they can access it. They're provided assistance with things like transportation to their medical appointments, if they need help with childcare during medical appointments, that sort of thing. We provide that assistance so people can get in care and stay in care. And African Americans in our program do extremely well.
Will you give us an idea, as far as Indiana is concerned, on how the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program is doing, and some of the information as to show its impact?
Sure. So in 2019, our program served almost 8,000 people in Indiana, and of the people receiving services, people did incredibly well. 88% of clients overall were virally suppressed, which means they were able to access their medication and take it every day. Among African Americans, that was closer to about 85% were virally suppressed. And once again, that has to do with the challenges we have in providing care and treatment equitably in this country.
When you look at Ryan White, his example, going back into the 70s and 80s, what, and this on the fact is just recent as well, observance, 40th anniversary observance. What do you feel that that Hoosiers as well as other Americans might have learned from Ryan's example, and how it fits very well with the our current event coming up, of course, the National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day?
Yeah, so I stand in awe of Ryan White. He was a young boy, as you all know, in Indiana, diagnosed at age 13 with HIV that he acquired through blood transfusion. And when his mom asked him what he wanted to do, he said, "I want to go to school and be a normal kid for the rest of my life," which they predicted would be 6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really prevented by doing that because of the tremendous stigma around HIV. By that point in time, we knew that HIV could not be transmitted in a classroom casually. Yet people were fearful of him. So he devoted the rest of his life. He ended up living several more years of beating the odds that his doctors had given him. But he spent the rest of his life fighting against HIV stigma. So that is incredibly important. And I can tell you that HIV stigma persists today. Ryan White provided important leadership in that area that continues to this date in terms of the need for reducing HIV stigma.
And I know his mother has continued on fighting the cause, so to speak.
Yes. So his mother is, we have a meeting of our national meeting of our program every 2 years. His mother is always there.
Mm-hmm.
To really continue to provide that inspiration around the importance of combating HIV stigma as an important barrier to people actually getting care and treatment services.
Now, I know the HRSA has a very important role in dealing with the HIV pandemic and trying to end it. Will you talk a little bit about the what's called the Plan for America initiative and how the Ryan White Center fits into it?
Yes. So thank you for that question. So we can end the HIV epidemic in this country. We have the tools, we have the science we need to end the epidemic. And we've worked with Dr. Fauci at NIH and with our colleagues at CDC to model how to do that. So by putting together the importance of HIV testing, which 1 in 7 people do not know they have HIV in this country, they're living with HIV. So we need to get everyone tested by increasing testing, increasing treatment. In our program, we do really well when people come into care, but a lot of people, because of stigma and discrimination, don't come into care when they know they have HIV. So we need to get people into care, make sure they know that there is low or no cost treatment available to them. And then we need to make sure that people that are continue to be at risk of HIV know about PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the idea that someone without HIV can take one pill once a day to prevent getting it if they're at high risk. So we put those things together with building better public health, and we can end this epidemic in 10 years. So we have a central role in that, particularly around getting people into care and treatment for HIV.
Does the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program have anything special planned, so to speak, as we come up to February 7th for the annual observance of the Awareness Day?
Yes, we definitely will take time out to look at the importance of HIV care and treatment during National Black HIV Awareness Day, and really highlighting the importance in the African-American community and the disproportionate impact that HIV continues to have today, to push to get the message out, particularly to African-American communities, about the importance of getting tested for HIV, and if you're living with HIV, to get into care and treatment.
Dr. Laura Cheever is a physician. She's also the associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau with the Health Resources and Services Administration. And Dr. Cheever, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again, not only about the event, about the bureau that you work for, but also about the great achievements and legacy, I guess, of Ryan White. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.